Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
This is Wednesday, August 27th. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the show. I am Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt.
So we want to acknowledge that there is breaking news out of Minneapolis, a shooting at a school, at least two children killed, 17 people injured. Prayers to the families and to the city of Minneapolis. This has to be a terrifying moment, just as children go back to school this week. And so we will be monitoring the situation as more information comes out of Minneapolis.
Well put, Cherry. As of now, though, we're going to continue with our show as planned. And what do we have up today?
So California Governor Gavin Newsom, who is a Democrat, he has blown up on social media for his memes, all caps, tweets and posts, and his trolling of President Donald Trump, a.k.a. the King of Trolls. Newsom has garnered hundreds of thousands of new followers online in just a few weeks, and many Democrats are applauding him. But Newsom isn't the only one. An image of the Baby Vance mural in Fishtown, a caricature of Vice President J.D. Vance, also went viral on social media, garnering over a million views online. And so that got us here at Studio 2 thinking about how troll tactics have moved from the internet's fringe to the political main stage. And we started to wonder whether this is a good thing or a bad thing and how this could impact governing and politics here. So today on the show, we're going to look at the rise of troll culture, social media stunts and politics. We have three guests. One is the man behind that viral mural that I just mentioned. And we'll look at how all of this will impact just how we have democracy here in our country. And we want to hear from you, our listeners at home, on the road or elsewhere. Our question of the day is this. What do you think about trolling as a political strategy? Should Democrats troll more? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, leave those comments in the chat.
And I think there's a couple ways to think about this topic, Cherry. One is that it's very difficult to break through these days without doing something that catches people's attention online. And that often is something provocative or negative. The other side of this is, you know, and this is top of mind right now, what do you do? How do you govern in this era of divisive politics and troll politics when a crisis happens?
Yeah.
When people need to unify.
Yeah, because trolling angers people, right?
Right.
But so you need people to come together.
If that is your path to power, then what do you do when you're in power when there are crisis moments? And so I think that is the other edge of the sword here and something that we want to get into this hour.
Yeah.
Again, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat. A couple local news stories to get to before, though, we get to that conversation. Wanted to start down at the Navy Yard in South Philadelphia. There was a big announcement yesterday. South Korea's president and Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro were on hand to unveil a $5 billion investment by a South Korean shipbuilding company. This is part of a larger agreement by South Korea to invest more money in American shipbuilders. This came just a day after South Korea's president met with Donald Trump at the White House. The Navy Yard, as many of you know, is a site of great historic and symbolic importance here in the city of Philadelphia. There was a huge fight to save the Navy Yard many decades ago. And so the fact that this investment is happening at the Navy Yard kind of amplifies the message and amplifies the importance of it.
Yeah. And I mean, you always got to follow the money. Anytime $5 billion is mentioned, I want to know what's going on. And it was so interesting because there wasn't a lot of coverage of this yesterday. So shout out to Fox 29 for its local coverage. You know, but when you have the president of South Korea and the first lady of South Korea, you know, there, you know, you want to pay attention. They talked about bringing new jobs and skills to the United States. They also plan on building two additional docks in the Navy Yard and to take production from two ships to 20 ships a year. And they're also talking about building oil and chemical tankers. So that's an industry we don't necessarily hear about in Philadelphia, but now there will be one.
We should note also that the talks around this go back to 2024 at least. So there was already conversations happening between the folks at the Navy Yard and South Korean manufacturers about bringing some of that business to the Navy Yard. Obviously, now it's been consummated. Big announcement yesterday down in South
christening,
Philly.
A christening.
A christening of sorts, yes. Yeah.
Second story is some Pennsylvania lawmakers, they want to protect same-sex marriage in the Commonwealth. Why, you ask? Isn't same-sex marriage already the law in America? Well, yes, it is. But the U.S. Supreme Court has been asked to take a case that could overturn Obergefell v. Hodges, the case that made it the law of the land back in 2014. Of course, the high court has not decided whether to take that case yet, but many fear that because it's out there, that marriage equality could be in jeopardy. So Democrats have tried for years to codify same-sex marriage in Pennsylvania, and so they see this fear as the reason to reintroduce the Marriage Equality Act, both in the State House and the Senate. And if it passed, it would provide that extra layer of protection for Pennsylvania couples who, if they lost the federal protection, they would still be protected right here in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, so I guess the way it works, right, is that the reason same-sex marriage is legal in many states and commonwealths across the country is because of that Supreme Court state decision. States did not themselves
pass any laws.
Right? And so if that protection were to go away, and we emphasize it's an if, right? If that were to go away, in many states, there would be it would revert back to
the old way of being. Yeah.
The pre-decision status quo. Yeah.
Yeah. And by the way, the Democratic House, they passed the Marriage Equality Act last year overwhelmingly with bipartisan support again. But that bill was never brought to a vote in the Senate. And so, you know, they have state reps that are now reintroducing it. And they say, look, let's just make sure that it can never go back to the way it was before 2014.
Obviously difficult to get that done, though, in a divided government without the help of Republicans in the Senate. So the effort is there. The question is whether that could result in
anything.
Yeah,
could they come together?
Yeah.
Could they come together?
So we're going to pivot now to our main topic today, which is trolling as a political strategy. It's become increasingly popular. Donald Trump, in many ways, is kind of like the Picasso of it, right?
I mean, he's really been
a pioneer in bringing that style of rhetoric to national politics. So what do you think about trolling as a political strategy? Do you think it's time for Democrats to troll more?
Is Governor Gavin Newsom on to something?
Right. Give us a call. 888-477-9499. You can email studio2 at whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat and we'll be right back.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Donald Trump has smashed the rules of political decorum. From mean nicknames to all caps social media posts, he has perfected the art of angering liberals.
So, is it time for Democrats to poke back? California Governor Gavin Newsom seems to think so. He's recently gone on a Trump-esque posting spree, mimicking and mocking the president's style.
And today on the show, internet trolling and politics. We will talk about the power of provocation in the internet age. Is it possible to win elections without trolling? And once you get power that way, how do you govern? We'll bring on a couple of political strategists later this hour, but let's start with Ken Bensinger, a reporter covering media and politics for The New York Times. Ken, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
We invite our listeners at home, on the road, and elsewhere to chime in. What do you think about trolling as a political strategy? Should Democrats troll more? Call 888-477-9499. You can email studio2 at whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
So Ken, we wanted to start with you. I mean, American politics used to be very bipartisan. Now we are on the internet, and the key goal is to go viral. How do we get here where political trolling is a strategy?
I mean, it's true that politics were very different before, but as you sort of hinted, there also wasn't an internet before, and that makes a big difference, really. And I think that I'm not a historian of the internet, but I think a lot of this starts, you know, around the 2015, 2016 campaign cycle, when particularly Republicans and particularly Donald Trump's campaign realized it could tap into the power of the internet in a way that had never done before. And to do that, it really tapped into a lot of the what we might consider the fringier and darker corners of the internet to help boost his online strategy. And so he and people working for him are drawing from places like 4chan and 8chan, which are these, they're on the open web. It's not dark web or something like that, but they're places where people can sort of freely speak and do and say things that in general discourse were considered really beyond the pale. And in that culture, it's sort of a completely like sort of on steroids version of the internet, people kind of get in a competition to say the most outrageous things, to do the most outrageous stunts, to be the cruelest or the funniest or the meanest or the most vile. And out of that culture, which some people could argue comes out of a previous thing called Gamergate, which was a big fight over gender in the world of video games. Out of that culture came the roots of a trolling kind of political approach that instead of sort of going after issues or, you know, accusing your rival of not voting the right way or being absent from Congress for a certain number of votes. So the kind of traditional things we saw about campaigns, now it is memes about your opponents or about the other party. And it's often unverifiable, if not untrue, personal attacks on candidates, and instead of coming just from the mouth of the candidate, it becomes dispersed, right? And people that support Trump in this case, and now others, are either copying them or amplifying them or innovating and doing their own things that also involve a candidate.
So it sounds like it's gone from being about the issues to being about the person. Is that what trolling is?
I think a lot of it is about the person. I mean, you control issues, but I think in a more basic sense, like the key to winning the internet when it comes to political things or just about anything else is going after personalities and people and make it's about an emotional resonance more than facts, right? So the point is to hit people where they feel it in their heart, whether or not a rational analysis of it holds up doesn't matter because the way people feel turns out to be so much more important than what they know.
But of course, that's always been the case, right? Mm-hmm. It's not like human psychology changed overnight. So, but why does the internet as a technology seem to elevate those types of messages maybe more than prior communication platforms?
Well, in the past, I think, you know, we were all limited to a pretty pretty narrow group of sources of information, right? There was newspapers, there was TV, there was radio. And that was largely it. That's where we all got our information. If you grew up in Seattle like I did, there was two local papers. And until like the 90s, you couldn't even get like the New York Times where I now work for at least a day after it came out. And there was no way to read it online because there was no internet. So you'd listen to local radio, you'd watch local news, and you'd read local papers and magazines, and that was it. And whether you were right or left or center, you're getting your information from the same narrow set of places. Internet totally breaks that structure, right? Now people can get news from all over the place and they don't have to limit themselves to cable TV or national TV or whatever. They can, there's hundreds, not thousands of places they can get their information. And on top of that, they can eliminate other types of information. They don't have to, not only do they not have to depend on newspapers anymore, they can never read the newspaper. They can only get the information from Twitter or what we call now X or Facebook or whatever, Instagram, and to the exclusion of everything else. And within Twitter or Instagram or any of these places, they can only follow a certain subset of people that are aligned to their values. So pretty soon, what makes it effective is that you can deliver information that gets those people who are only receiving that information. And when all they see is, you know, Joe Biden is like a lizard man. He's been dead for 50 years and he's a, you know, and that's all they see all day long. Well, they start to believe it, right? Those kind of extreme things when your only source of information it comes to you like that, that it makes it easy. On top of that, you have the sort of idea of citizen journalism, or the fact that everyone can be involved in spreading information. Now, everyone with who can get a Twitter account, everyone with an email address can add to the discourse. And so people who are not journalists, who are not newsmakers, are now reaching more people than most journalists are,
Yeah.
just because they're good at that medium.
It sort of democratized journalism in a lot of ways. But I want to sort of, talk about the fact that, those on the right seem to more embrace this, led by Donald Trump, seem to embrace this strategy, whereas Democrats sort of rebuffed it and were slow to adopt it. Why do you think that is, from your perspective as someone who covers the media?
I mean, I think there is at least there has been a significant cultural difference between the two parties in terms of messaging. And not that Democrats don't like to grab you by the heartstrings and win votes that way, but there was this idea that you think back to like Hillary Clinton's famous line about when they go low, we go high, that kind of stuff. There's this idea that you can win the people by sort of being honest and being forthright and never stretching the truth and not, debasing yourself to the common populace or something. And Republicans, I think, were less uptight about dropping those pretenses and more strategic and some would argue cynical about what, about the value of just basically going for any emotional response you can. And Democrats have been slow to pick that up. And I think, the idea of this show you're doing is like the Democrats are starting to change on that or starting to adapt to it. I think they have been slow to do that. And I think it's probably their detriment. I mean, it reminds me of a debate that's not about memes, but this idea about redistricting and whether California, for example, should follow suit.
Yeah, it's very similar to that. Yeah, sort of like, should you go tit for tat, or should you try to develop some sort of high road? I did want to point out, I think that they go low. I think that was Michelle Obama during the Clinton campaign. Yeah,
as I was saying it, my brain broke.
It's okay.
I do want to read this comment from Mike, one of our regulars out in Germantown, who says Dems have been trolling President Trump, forever. It's not an invention by Republicans. Dems have played the game for a long time. I guess there is a little bit of a nuance here about sort of what trolling is. Democrats have certainly said lots of negative things in the past about Donald Trump. And one of his sort of defenses has always been, I only hit back. They attack me and I hit back. I do think, though, if you did like a media analysis of it, there's like a textural difference between how he communicates that negativity versus how a lot of Democrats communicate their negativity toward him. I'm trying to sort of find a way to put my finger on it. I don't know if you can help me, Ken, about sort of what that difference, that distinction really is.
Look, I mean, there's a reason why people for time immemorial thought of politicians as being less than honest all the time, right? It is not limited to one political party, right? And people stretch the truth for political advantage forever. But I think there is this, we've seen a problem of what we might call the whataboutism, which is, the media, our kind of media, the mainstream media, wants to be fair and cover both sides. And so we treat the kind of stretching of the truth by the left and the right as equal. And I think many, many studies have shown that's not the case. It's true that Democrats sometimes do it, but the preponderance of it is coming from the right. And, it's also used by the right against the right. If you think back to the primary period for the last presidential election, people who supported Donald Trump spread an unbelievable amount of misinformation about Ron DeSantis, who was the Florida governor trying to win the presidential nomination. And, there was stories that his wife, Casey DeSantis, had faked breast cancer. There was all this stuff about him using lifts in his shoes to make himself look taller, which was never even close to proven to be true, but was spread so much that everyone sort of began to believe it. So it's a weapon that isn't just used against Democrats. Democrats, at least in the past, tended to stretch the truth as opposed to making things up whole cloth. Again, I think that's starting to change for good or for bad, but I don't think it's really fair to just say the two parties are equal in this. I mean, the Republicans have been extremely sophisticated about, or supporters of Trump and the MAGA movement have been extremely sophisticated in their approach to just inventing things for political benefit. I mean, to bring up Michelle Obama in this conversation, I'm pretty sure I have this ID correct. There is a consistent an utterly unfounded idea on the right that Michelle Obama is actually a man, and it never stops. And that and you see not just fringe people in the GOP do this, but people who are now currently working in the White House have spread that story. People who are in the FBI have talked about it on podcasts, things like that. So I can't think of too many equivalent ones on the left.
And I want to read a quote because White House Communications Director Stephen Chung posted on X back in July. A lot of reporters, he says, and liberals love to pearl clutch, making being offended part of their entire existence. It's that type of out of touch snobbery that makes everyday Americans laugh at them. That's what he has said. And so I want to sort of talk about this whole taking that trolling, that making up of falsities, to government, because now if you follow the White House Instagram page, you see AI generated images of the president with muscles ripped down his arm. You see, all kinds of memes and things from a government account, something you have never seen from past leaders. And so can you talk about how some of these images, I mean, there's an image of him, if you're watching it on YouTube, with the suit looking like with fireworks behind him, the flag, money all around him. I mean, just talk about what it means to take trolling and make it a part of a government function. That's something we have not seen.
Yeah, that's true. And I'm glad you flashed up that image. And the White House account is a really interesting one to look at, exactly for what you're talking about, because it's transgressive in the sense that it's breaking all kinds of sort of norms that we think government agencies should do. And that's spread, by the way, to other agencies. If you look at the DHS website, or excuse me, Twitter account, for example, or other agencies, they're doing that as well. And so they'll turn a detention of an undocumented immigrant into some kind of a big joke. And they'll, like, there was a woman who cried when she was going to be deported, and they turned it into some kind of hilarious, what they thought, joke about oh, the poor crying immigrant kind of thing, and mocked this person, all over the internet. And think what you want about immigration, being picked up and thrown away from your family is got to be traumatic for an individual. And so the idea that that's humorous is, I think, really different, that the government would support that kind of messaging. And I think it touched on something else, which I failed to mention earlier, which is one of the effective things to do with this kind of trolling is to make people laugh, right? And get people's attention. And of course, we're in an attention economy. People can scroll through to anything they want. So how do you get people to stop on something? And one of the ways is with a joke. And sometimes jokes have strong political messages. So of course Donald Trump does not have, like, Arnold Schwarzenegger arms, and is not, it doesn't have that body, but people love it because it's kind of a mixture of funny and also an ideal that they kind of like. And it underneath that there's a bit of a subliminal message about masculinity and about power and about dominance. And I think a lot of the stuff that you referenced about how the left is snowflakes who can't take a joke has to do with that idea of expressing dominance, right? That being dominant and being cruel is a sign of power, and that being subjected and being and having feelings is a sign of weakness. And that turns out to be really popular. A lot of people in the country really react to that. They like the idea of what we're learning this. They say they voted for it. We're learning that a lot of people like to see other people suffer. They seem to like the idea of people, getting punished. You go online and you use a lot of people who want everyone in jail. They want every Democrat in jail, or they want every congressperson in jail. They want to see people suffer. They feel a lot of grievance. It's not always clear what their grievance is. You see someone who has what appears to be a pretty good life, feel a lot of anger at people that they've never interacted with.
Mixed response from the audience so far. George says, "I don't know if trolling is the overall correct response, but to the extent that Newsom's jabs caused the MAGA crew to quiet down, then that is a plus." Beans47 on YouTube says, "Trolling in politics is cringe. Also, I feel like the trolling allows plausible deniability, like you can just keep saying outrageous things, but rely on it being a joke." Let me bring in a caller now. This is Anise from Cherry Hill on line two. You're on Studio Two. What's your question or comment?
Hi guys. First of all, love the show. Big fan.
Thank you.
I think especially for the younger generation, trolling is absolutely needed. The current president has been nothing but divisive, and if anyone's been cringe, it's him. Gavin Newsom is finally criticizing and trolling the president, which should have been done a long time ago. If you want to engage a younger audience, you need to make them laugh, but you also need to have a message. And Gavin Newsom is the first person who's really done that effectively. Two things.
Yep.
In previous fascist regimes, trolling and mocking the fascist government has been one of the most important tools in breaking the hold that these fascist governments have had over the people. And number two, I think that the media in general, and first of all, I'm a big fan of your guys' show and NPR.
Thank you.
The media in general has not done a good job of accurately describing what the Trump administration is doing to this country. It is pure fascism. They have the military stationed against its own citizens. They just took over Amtrak station in Washington, D.C. this morning. Every movement they've made has been straight from the fascism textbook. And I don't think the media is sounding the alarm bells loud enough. For what they're actually doing to the American people.
Before I let you go, you said you feel like historically this type of like mockery and trolling and the punching back rhetorically has been able to break what you described as fascist regimes. I'm just curious what you're thinking about there. Like what's your reference point?
In the 1940s, Nazism was prevalent and it arose in much of the same way that the current Trump administration is doing things, and mockery and, you know, things like political cartoons demonstrating how absurd their behavior was one of the tools that was used to break the hold that these administrations have over their supporters. Their supporters need to realize how ridiculous their leader is. I mean, he wears makeup. He's always promoting himself as this muscular American man, and he's literally anything but. And more American people need to wake up and realize that. And unfortunately, mockery is one of the tools that we need to use.
Well, thank you so much. That was Anise in Cherry Hill. So on that point, maybe we should bring in someone who I think agrees with a lot of those points there.
Yeah, and we've had a few examples of real-life trolling here in Philadelphia. A Tesla smash featuring Philly Elmo to protest Doge cuts. And most recently, I mentioned that viral meme-style mural of Vice President J.D. Vance on the side of a restaurant in Fishtown. And both of those stunts were pulled off by the same organization, and we have the founder with us in the studio. We have Jack Einecker, the executive director and founder of FUBAR PAC. Welcome to Studio 2, Jack.
Thank you for having me on the show. And I want to first off kind of set the tone of the morning, because what we're seeing out of Minnesota is absolutely horrific.
Yes.
And as a dad of school-age children and as an American, my heart breaks. But it continues to break so many years in a row, and because of, you know, the proliferation of weaponry out in the streets. But I think that largely more speaks to kind of what bipartisanship has gotten us. It has not advanced the causes that we want to see and the values that we hold dear.
Yeah, one of the things you said off mic before the show started is that bipartisanship hasn't made movement in some of the areas, even like gun violence. And so can you kind of take us back to why you decided to get into this space of, you know, creating memes, creating political stunts that get people's attention?
Well, I think it does exactly just that. It gets attention. You know, my generation is not tuning in to the evening news. They're usually not watching commercials. You're not seeing a lot of political commercials outside of live sports. So where are folks? They are on Instagram. They are on Twitter. I'm not calling it X. I want to make sure that we're reaching those folks. And when we do, that we're doing something loud, that we're doing something interesting that grabs your attention. And take for our J.D. Vance mural.
The talk of the cookout. In my neighborhood, last week.
Absolutely. And we put up, you know, that cost nothing, more or less. It was a 10-foot tall mural that cost $300 and yielded us 5 million views in the very first week. But it's not enough to just put a meme of J.D. Vance looking sweaty and bald and gross up on the side of a building. Our videos that we put out afterwards highlighted the real damage and danger that this administration is causing, like the cuts to USAID, which is going to kill 14 million people, 4 million of which are children, along with the cuts to Medicaid, which is going to kill an American every single 11
Jack,
minutes.
How do we get from I see a mural to that?
Well, it's on our socials. right? So when you go to FUBARPAC.org, I pitch the site, you're going to see video content that includes that. So I think that when you see a giant sweaty mural of J.D. Vance on a wall and it has our tag, you're probably going to go look into it, you know? And we're going to try to spin a little bit of message at you. Look, I'm not the one out here setting the tone of all Democratic politics. I don't think that's necessary, but there's got to be somebody in the back of the class throwing spitballs at Republicans, and that's the shoes I want to fill. I think I step in very big shoes, like Jon Stewart, who was doing it for years, and his voice was really lost during the first Trump administration.
So it sounds like you give sugar with, you give people sugar to help the medicine go down.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so where did you come up? Where do you come up with the stunts? Like, what in your mind says, you know what, I want to take this caricature of the vice president, making him look, somebody told me he looked like a garbage pail kid, right?
Yeah.
And I'm going to use that to get attention.
So this all started, I can just tell you about the process with this particular mural, but it had just been a friend of mine that we had been sending these memes back and forth to each other. And she's in politics, I am as well. I said to her, let's paint this on the side of a building. You know, I always start, I've worked in politics for, you know, almost 20 years now, organizing veterans at every single level. I myself am an Air Force veteran, hence the name FUBARPAC. So I wanted to try something different after coming off this last campaign. You know, there were things that I wanted to do during that campaign that I didn't have the freedom to do when I ran Veterans and Military Families for Harris Walls. And I knew that this was a tone that I think I wanted to add to. I think Governor Newsom is doing exactly that. He is brilliant with the deployment of memes. And I want to push back against the New York Times writer that you had on, because while, you know, we're deploying memes to express a point, the other side's using memes to lie, right? And to be cruel. On the left,
So is that like your personal red line with all this? Like that's what you won't cross into, even if it got you more attention?
No, I'm not going to lie. I think that you undercut your own values. I still am going into this with values, and I want to tell the truth. I want to tell the truth about what the damage that the administration is doing. But at the same time,
well, let me ask you, we're not going to grab attention like without this existential fight, though, and you've got to win this fight between you and like what our caller called the fascist opposition. Are you then fighting with one hand behind your back if you're not willing to sort of lie back? Like they can do memes and you're saying they can lie. We can do memes. We can't lie. So aren't their memes going to do better than your memes? If you look at it as sort of like a no holds barred type of fight.
No, I will say I don't think that we do have to go out and lie about the issues. I don't lie in our materials. Everything we come from is very fact checked, very based in truth. When we smashed a Tesla, the reason we smashed a Tesla was to bring attention to the cuts to Doge that they were doing, and talk about the massive cuts to stuff like veterans' healthcare and cuts to cancer research. My dad passed away in January, and I'm not sure if the cancer research that the government was doing could have helped him or other families, but we understand what the cruelty is being wrecked by the other side, and we've got to fight back. We've got to fight back by grabbing the attention of folks who want to get involved, and then give a way for people to get involved. So one of the things with FUBARPAC is we put up this mural. People have been asking me, you know, when are you coming to Cincinnati? When are you going to come to New York? When are you going to come do this? I'm not going there.
Yeah.
But what we are doing is later this week, we're putting out on our site a paint by numbers that you can get a projector yourself, put it up on a wall, trace it out, or go get it printed out yourself and paint it by numbers yourself.
And the same then, mural design.
Exactly. Yeah. And have a conversation with your friends about, hey, here's the damage that this administration is doing in a way that is engaging people in something fun, a fun little activity that isn't, you know, saying to people, oh, you have to get involved. We need to get a different way for more people to get involved on their level.
So your ultimate goal is to activate people, to get people to stand up and work together. So I want to ask this question, Jack, to you, and then I would love for Ken to weigh in. So how do you take this type of getting attention, this type of riling folks up emotionally, right, and And if you want to get something done, you most of the time you do need to bring folks in, at least some from the other side. How do you take it to the next step, which is governance?
Well, I think that you have to get back into governance, or excuse me, you have to get back into government to govern, right? So the process of getting there is sometimes more important than what we're going to do when we get there. I think that there's very smart folks out there in the Democratic Party that are putting together the Project 2025 equivalent to draw out like a grand vision for what that governance is actually going to look like. But until we can move the needle on the trust that is put in Republicans on issues like Medicaid, mm-hmm. Medicare, Social Security, cost of living, those are the things that resonate. And those are the things that we come back to with my PAC, that is our home base. Nothing we produce is not going to come back there and explain what the damage that's being done.
You don't
is.
Think it might make governing harder, though?
I think governing is already hard. I think that we've seen what not having a supermajority does. We see how quickly people are to equivocate. The loss of the public option even came at the hands of not having enough people that were going to stick by their guns. I think that that's part of the problem with the Democratic message sometimes is that we aren't strong enough yeah. to actually commit to say, hey, here's what we actually believe. Here's what we're going to get done and then deliver on that.
A lot of this is premised, though, on the idea that it's what has worked for Trump and the Republicans, mm-hmm. right? And I do wonder a little bit like how true that is. Okay, so you won a couple elections, but it's you only have two choices essentially in this system. And Trump's polling numbers have never been awesome, and they certainly are not awesome right now. Mm-hmm. And he inspires plenty of backlash. So I do wonder a little bit like, is Trump really that popular? Does this work all that well? Is the internet really real life?
It works for him. It's funny that you bring that up because we don't usually in FUBAR PAC's messaging, we don't usually target Trump because there's a lot of, as you brought up yeah. earlier, a lot of noise there. What we do is we try to find a villain of the week to go after and highlight. So we move quickly between oppositions. So, but at the end of the day, I want to make sure that, you know, are we going to move back into a different cycle where people are, you know, all hunky-dory? Probably. Yeah. But that's 10 years down the road. We're in this fight right now.
So you don't think it's cyclical. You're just saying in this moment, we have to adopt this tone because that is the tone of the moment.
100%.
And we'll shift 5 years later when a new Obama comes along or whomever.
Yeah, I absolutely think that. And I think that you see that with the messaging of the most popular politicians of today. Look at what Mondami has done up in New York. Mm-hmm. He's presenting a very hopeful vision, I would say, for New York, and people have resonated with it. But at the same time, he hasn't pulled his punches online, and he's been very out there with that.
So it sounds like because this is the tone that Trump has set, and he is a troll, this is the only way to fight back at this moment, fight troll with troll.
I think that it is making sure that when we're not just accepting the premise of what they're giving us. Take something like, trans women in sports. All right. There is too much equivocation on the Democratic side to accept the premise instead of hitting back and mm-hmm. saying, look, this is a non-issue, you are more likely to be crushed under a vending machine in America than you are to play a trans person in collegiate sports. And what I just told you is wrong because you are five times more likely to be crushed under a vending machine.
Yeah.
So I think it's hitting back, taking what they're not taking the premise of what they're giving you and then giving them something, you know, something entertaining in return.
Yeah. We're going to go to a break right now. Let me read this comment from Becky, who says Newsom goes into defense rather than offense. I like it. Molly questions all yeah. this, says, are the adults in the room with us? The rise of political trolling seems to me like the final nail in the coffin of basic human decency. And lots of other comments
yeah.
strolling in. Daniil says, these are the times. People don't understand complex debate anymore. Well, perhaps we'll challenge that on the other side of this break on Studio 2.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. This update now on the breaking news situation in Minneapolis, Minnesota. An 8-year-old and a 10-year-old were killed and at least 17 other people injured in a shooting at a church service this morning at a Minneapolis Catholic school.
Officials say the attacker fired at the group through windows before shooting and killing himself. You can stay with WHYY for updates from NPR throughout the day, including the 1 p.m. newscast.
Now back to our conversation today on Studio 2. We've been talking about trolling as a political strategy this hour. Gavin Newsom, California's Democratic governor, has been mimicking President Trump's social media style, tweets, memes, and more. It's a popular strategy among Republican influencers and some GOP politicians, but Democrats have been a little slower to catch on.
Yeah, and at the end of last segment, we heard from Jack Einecker, the executive director and founder of FUBAR PAC. We appreciate him being with us today. Ken Bessinger is still with us. He is a reporter covering media and politics for The New York Times. And joining us now is Ray Zabrany, a GOP political consultant and the founder and partner at Red Maverick Media. Ray, welcome to Studio 2.
Hey, thanks for having me. Excited to be on.
And by the way, for our listeners at home and elsewhere, the question of the day is, what do you think about trolling as a political strategy? Should Democrats troll more? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And those on Facebook and YouTube, keep those comments coming in the live chat.
Before we bring in Ray, let's bring in a caller to maybe pivot this conversation a bit. Mm-hmm. This is John from Lower Merion. Hey, John, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you very, very much for your time in this very important conversation. My point is that, first and foremost, I completely believe in DEI and the equality of all people. Second, what is going on right now in our federal government is appalling and outrageous. Third, we cannot beat back what is appalling and outrageous by then becoming appalling and outrageous ourselves, because that vitriol leads to violence. What Trump is a symptom of something much greater. He is a symptom of a large portion of our population losing faith in our political system because it has been completely bought and sold by special interest. And if the Democrats want to have a message that's going to resonate, basically it's the Reform Party who is going to put in place the constitutional amendments necessary to bar campaign finance and focus on the bread and butter issues like affordable housing, food, jobs, the things that people actually care about. And once those things are dealt with, the dialogue will decrease and people will not be as interested in the circus of politics because their needs have been met.
All right. That's John from Lower Merion and Buggy on YouTube. Similar sentiment. Mm-hmm. I don't agree with the whole we go high mentality. I don't think trolling, however, is necessarily a solution. I think the solution is taking things like rising fascism seriously and tackling them. So, basically fighting back with substance and policy prescriptions. Mm-hmm. So let's bring in Ray Zabrany now. Ray, I'm just curious how you have watched political messaging on the right change over your career. When you got into this versus now, what do you see as like the big shift?
Well, look, I think it goes without saying Donald Trump has been a big shift for everything in politics. Certainly messaging and the way to communicate has changed a lot since I've gotten involved. I think what I saw when I started were, more kind of mainstream communication tactics, and we were for lower taxes, and the other side was for higher taxes, et cetera, et cetera. And now I think not only has Donald Trump changed, but I think people have changed and attention spans. We are now in an attention economy, right? That's what we're fighting over, trying to grab attention away from all of the other things we compete with, whether that be, your favorite show on streaming, whether that be, your other day-to-day activities. And so we are at a time when things have to be given to us in bite-sized morsels, and they got have to be interesting because you're competing with things like Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce getting engaged.
Yeah.
And, you know, that is taking up a lot of the oxygen. So that is what happens. And look, Donald Trump, for better or worse, without talking about policy, talking about communicating, if you think about this, he certainly started this kind of, if you will, trolling, as you've been referring to it, but certainly get cutting right to the heart of these issues and cutting right to the heart of, and not being afraid to communicate in ways that, quite frankly, people think. The one thing I've said about Donald Trump is people think he said a lot of things that people think, and whether you want to admit you agree with them or you want to be mad about them or anything, he gets you talking about Donald Trump. And that's what really has been the genius of his communication strategy. Again, whether you agree with the things he says or not, you're always talking about him. I think that's reflective in the Democrats as yeah. well, as you can tell. They're mimicking him, and yep. therefore, you know, they're talking about him.
Totally. I think one of the big questions, though, Ray, moving forward, and sometimes it's hard for people to see a forward past Trump, sure. but there is somewhere down the line, is whether he is sort of like one of one, right? And I believe that your firm has worked with, like, you know, Larry Hogan, Susan Collins, not very Trumpy figures who've sure. won big elections very recently. So I think there is a question for political strategists such as yourself moving forward about, like, what is the currency of this outside of Donald Trump or post-Trump? How do you think about that?
Well, I think everyone has to understand that, and to your point, Donald Trump is one of one, right? Nobody will be able to do what he's done in the same manner. Now, that doesn't mean that we automatically go back to the old ways, if you will. I think there will be a combination of what you see now, along with, you know, some more traditional communications. I think, look, J.D. Vance is the vice president. He is definitely the vice troller in chief. He has a very good way of handling himself on social media in order to generate attention, in order to be in the conversation. The other thing that I give Vance credit for is he doesn't take himself too seriously. He's able to make fun of himself, whether it be the memes that you've seen and everything else. So, I think you'll see people still doing this sort of thing, but in a different way. Donald Trump is definitely one of one. And look, Donald Trump gets away with saying things that no other politician would have ever gotten away with saying. I can remember watching an interview in 2007 where he talked about John McCain and said, you know, I like my war heroes that didn't get shot, or is to something to that effect. And for any other traditional candidate, that would have been the end of their campaign. But here, because he was speaking to what the caller actually just alluded to, the frustration of the federal government and kind of this feeling of nobody had heard me, you know, the average person. I think that really gave him a weapon that nobody else had.
Yeah. Ken, I want to bring you back into the conversation. I want you to comment on, what does this do to politics? Because there was a time when our president and our senators and our politicians were kind of above the fray, right? They were kind of the ones who spoke truth and all of that. What does bringing trolling into the political conversation and making that a strategy, what does it do to America's view of our leadership?
So I want to say, I mean, if you read history books, you'll see that presidents behind closed doors throughout history have been some pretty scrappy things and some pretty things that they wouldn't want the public to know, right? But they've always kept that behind the doors, and there's always been a consciousness, at least in the modern, you know, era of sort of radio onward, of being able to communicate with the masses. There's been a real difference between what they say in front of a microphone, or in this case, the internet, and what they would do behind the closed doors of the Oval Office. And now, I mean, Trump's the ultimate expression of that new paradigm, because he invites the media and everyone into the Oval Office for everything, right? And the cabinet meetings are televised. So it's a complete sort of total awareness environment for that. And I don't, Jack earlier talked about how we can go back to how things were in a few years. And I don't actually fully believe that. I think there's just a major change in the way that information is carried. I don't think we're going to be able to retreat from. I think Gavin provides us a really interesting test case about what Ray said about the attention economy, which is there's two things going on there. One, he is attacking Trump's style of messaging, right? He's not, as Ray said, he's not doing something new. He's making fun of the kind of messaging that the Trump administration and MAGA uses, right? And the point there, I think, is to draw attention to it. But the other thing he's trying to do is to draw attention to himself, right? I mean, you know, he is very cognizant of the fact that he's looking for a way for people to talk about him. So, you know, attempts to seem sort of potentially, you know, like a leader and dignified and traditional, maybe weren't moving the needle for him as much as he'd hoped.
Yeah.
Prize pot thing and has Steve Bannon and people like that on his show as another attempt to draw attention to himself. And now he's trying this, and this perhaps has been the most successful. And you can measure it because if you look at Fox News, they can't stop talking about Gavin Newsom, right? And so in an attention economy, I think Ray would probably agree with me here. In attention economy, the only thing that really matters is that people are talking about you. It doesn't really matter if it's positive or negative. It's just look at me, look at me.
Well, before we go, I just want to make sure we give Ray one more thought here. Only about 45 seconds left, Ray. But do you believe there is a cyclical nature to this? People will be seeking a post-Trump politician who has like sort of a more traditional type of decorum? Or do you think, we've crossed the Rubicon and we're never going back?
So again, Trump's 101, so I don't think it'll be to the extent it is now. But I think this is part of the dialogue right now, and it will continue to be as long as X is around, as long as, you know, all of these social media, you got to talk fast, you're competing for attention. I think you're going to continue to see people look for every way to engage folks. But a lot of this, a lot of this engages folks who are for you, right? Gavin Newsom's trolling has energized Democrats. Donald Trump's trolling energizes Republicans. At the end of the day in the campaign, you're going to have to convince the people who don't pay any mind to this kind of stuff.
Yep.
You're still going to have to convince them.
Yep.
And so you'll still have some of that back to the old tradition. That's why Larry Hogan and Susan Collins and people like that still win.
Yep. That's a great point. That's Ray Zaborni, GOP political consultant, founder and partner at Red Maverick Media. Thanks for being with us, Ray.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And Ken Bensinger is a reporter covering media and politics for The New York Times. Thanks for staying with us the whole hour, Ken.
My pleasure.
Want to read this from Nick. This conversation is making me think of the last line of Animal Farm. The creatures outside looked from pig to man and from man to pig and from pig to man again. But already it was impossible to say which was which. Make your own interpretation of that one.
Interesting. Thanks to everybody who wrote in, called in. And thanks to our producers, Debbie Bilzer, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory from Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. We will talk with you tomorrow.